All right, so tonight we start the month-long exploration into communication as Dharma in daily life. And this is one of the, you know, sometimes I think of it as the last frontier, or just how do you actually communicate with another person? How do you actually hear what they're saying for you to be heard? So I'm including this really as a two-way street as we explore the whole month, you know, how we speak, how we write, how we text, and also how we listen and the feedback between those two. And tonight we'll focus more on our own speaking, again, wise speech. And next 2 weeks we'll focus more on how we listen. How do we hear the feedback and give and take of communication, the back and forth aspect. And by communication, let's include that very broadly to include every form that we can think of, both verbally, written, email, text, social media. And we'll stick mostly with the social, with the interpersonal, not look at the advertising or media, or should I say even fake news, all that stuff, even though that applies to communication. But more what, how we personally choose to communicate with each other, with another person or persons, and how you listen, how you receive that communication. So what did the Buddha have to say about communication? He actually said quite a bit around wise speech. This is part of the Eightfold Path, and there's really four elements that we'll kind of highlight and explore tonight. From the discourses, the Buddha says, and what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. This is wise speech. So let's go through each of these four, and beginning with abstaining from lying or speaking what is only true. Now, this is the most emphasized of these elements of wise speech. And so we'll spend most of the time tonight exploring that. And there's really two elements. I think it's helpful to see that there's the abstaining from lying is one thing, and then speaking what is true is a different thing. And it's helpful to separate those two out because they're really not always the same thing, unfortunately. Now, there's a lovely sutta that really pulls out the personality in some ways of the Buddha and his life. And he's giving instructions to a new monk who happens to be his son, who's 7 years old. And I'm not sure, but I think his son had maybe told a little lie. Right? So the Buddha comes up, follows, finds where he is, and walks up to him. And the Buddha, the son is named the Venerable Rahula, sees the Buddha from afar and creates a seat for him and gets a bowl out for him to wash his feet. So the Buddha sits down and washes his feet. And then he looks at Rahula and says, having left a little bit of water in the little bit of water in the water dipper, he says to Rahula, Rahula, do you see this little bit of leftover water remaining in the water dipper? You can imagine this little 7-year-old saying, yes, sir. That's how little of a spiritual life there's in anyone who feels no shame at telling a deliberate lie. It's just that little bit of water. Then he takes that water and he tosses it. And having tossed away that little bit of leftover water, the Buddha says to Rahula, Rahula, do you see how this little bit of leftover water is tossed away? Yes, sir. Rahula, whatever is there of a spiritual life in anyone who feels no shame at telling a deliberate lie is tossed away just like that. And he continues the lesson. Having turned the water dipper upside down, the Buddha says to the Venerable Rahula, Rahula, do you see how this water dipper is now turned upside down? Yes, sir. Rahula, whatever is left of a spiritual life and anyone who feels no shame at telling a deliberate lie is turned upside down just like that. And then finally, the Buddha says, okay, turns that water dipper right side up. And he says, you see how empty and hollow this water dipper is? Yes, sir. Rahula, whatever there is of a contemplative, of a spiritual life and anyone who feels no shame in telling a deliberate lie is empty and hollow just like that. Right? So you picture him taking this very concrete metaphor and description showing how telling a deliberate lie really throws away your spiritual growth, your spiritual path. And he goes further. In the same way, Ruhula, when anyone feels no shame in telling a deliberate lie, there's no evil, I tell you, that he will not do. Right? So anyone who feels no shame in telling a deliberate lie, there is no evil, I tell you, that he will not do. Thus, Ruhula, you should train yourself. I will not tell a deliberate lie, even in jest. Even in jest. So this is such a vivid example, vivid description of the effects of telling a lie. He's really demonstrating this in a very simple way that we can understand, even as our 2,600 years ago and his son, 7 years old, did. Because when we tell a lie without shame, without remorse, what's happening there? We're really denying what is true, what is real. We're saying, okay, that's not the truth. And one way we can really frame our spiritual practice is discovering what is actually true. What is actually true, and seeing through our delusion, our ignorance, to clearing through all of that to see what and who we really are, the true nature of life and ourselves. This is and to know what is true and to tell a deliberate lie instead without shame has this effect of profoundly disconnecting us from reality. We're choosing to inhabit this land of imagination, of fantasy, of maybe a fear of anxiety. And we start to behave as if that is reality instead of made up. We start to confuse those two. And more significant, we start to convince or force others to participate in what's imagined. And usually in some ways to serve ourselves, to protect, defend, to avoid, to promote our own interest. So you can see that once we go down that slippery slope of denying what's true, then how far is it to denying someone else's right for their possessions, for their safety, for their life? Just part of that same denial of what's actually true. So this one aspect of wise speech is so deeply emphasized by the Buddha. Now imagine for a moment if this world, somehow we could snap our fingers and suddenly no one would be able to tell a deliberate lie. How transformational that would be throughout our world. I mean, our whole political system would probably collapse. But we have to have something else come up in its place. Another sutta, the Buddha says that, okay, thus she doesn't consciously tell a lie for her own sake, for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. Abandoning false speech, she abstains from false speech. She speaks the truth, holds to the truth, is firm, reliable, no deceiver of the world. Now, abstaining from telling a lie is a little different than speaking what's true. It may not be that much different, but sometimes it is different. Because we're often clearer about what is not true. We know, okay, I definitely saw that, I definitely witnessed that, I experienced that. And also by our own internal mechanism of feedback, mechanism of tension we may feel. As you practice more and more, telling a deliberate lie becomes more and more uncomfortable internally. It doesn't matter if anyone knows that you're lying. It's just like you know it. As Ruth Dennison, she's passed away now, but she was a very famous teacher in this tradition, once said that you can't get away with anything when you start to practice, because you start to know yourself more and more deeply. You start to know when there's that dissonance, when there's that contraction. And it gets to the point where you start to say something that's untrue and you just feel this internal contraction. It becomes less and less tolerable. It becomes actually painful internally. And you start to long for those times when you're aligned and true and integritous. And there's a way that you relax. There's a sense of settling, a sense of feeling like you're okay, I'm grounding, touching on the earth. So we start to value and appreciate that feeling of alignment more and more of speaking the truth. But one of the other issues about practice, you start to wonder, okay, what is really true? What can I absolutely say is actually true? Because think back before you practiced, you maybe thought more things were true than you realize there are now. What I mean by your ideas, your opinions, your concepts. Even you start to realize that memory, perception is all very much conditioned by our past history, our past experience. One person's experience is not shared by another, even though they're both living through the same event. So we need this inner honesty, this sense of fundamental prerequisite of being completely honest with ourselves, even if we may not be with other people, to actually know more and more what's actually true versus our conditioning. What is our conditioning around this experience, this mind state, this situation? Sometimes when we hear about speaking the truth, we go around and telling other people what we think of them because we think it's the truth. And you start off the conversation by saying, you are always, or this is who you are, this is what you are. We're already on pretty thin ice. Because how do we really know another person? I mean, really deeply know them. Because the more we start to understand ourselves, we start to see how hard it is to define ourselves. We actually start to look deeply. We start to look at those cherished beliefs, those ideas, those concepts that, okay, that was who I was. But we start to see how much of that is just a thought that's been rehearsed and believed in year after year. We start to see the changing mind states and senses of self come and go through the day. We start to see the fallacy of our own perceptions, of our biases, of our prejudices, our memories. We start to see how a moment's experience is very much shaped and conditioned by our past. So there may be a relative truth, but not absolute. For those of you familiar with Byron Katie, she speaks to this quite a bit. When you have some mind state or some experience which is very stressful or very gripping, ask these four questions. Is it true? The second question, can you absolutely know it's true? And then question three, how do you react? What happens when you believe that thought? And four, who would you be without that thought? So you take something, you know, a thought like, hey, I'm inadequate, or I have this opinion or this idea, and you start to look and see, is it truly actually true? Or is it just a thought that I believed in? Is it a thought that I've adopted? So in this way, we start to hold that, okay, that speaking what's true much more lightly. Okay, this is my experience. This is what I did. This is what I saw. But holding that it's not the complete truth. It's not the whole statement of reality. Owning this incomplete nature of our perception and observation. Now, when speaking about what's true, the Buddha gave some other instructions as well. He talked about it being, needs to be both not only true, but also beneficial. It also have to have the right timing. There's another interesting sutta that the Buddha kind of lays this out. Again, it's interesting because it shows kind of the struggles he had interpersonally, the dynamics of that time. And I'll go a little bit more into that later in the talk. But to summarize it, this is to Prince Abhayaya for the Middle Length Discourses 58. I'm just going to read Tanasero Bhikkhu's introduction. And in this discourse, the Buddha shows the factors that go into deciding what is and is not worth saying. Okay, wise speech. The main factors are three. Whether or not a statement is true, whether or not is beneficial, and whether or not is pleasing to others. Okay, so the Buddha himself would only state those things which are true and beneficial. But would have a sense of time for those which are pleasing and unpleasing, when they should be shared. Okay? So something may be true, but if it's not beneficial, than not to say it. And if it's true and beneficial and it's not pleasing, you kind of see when's the right timing to approach that, when the right time to share that. And same thing, if it's pleasing, to also notice when's the right timing for it to be the most skillful. So this is this first element of wise speech, abstaining from lying and also speaking what is true. So the next three, a little briefer, a little bit more pointed toward the intention behind our communication. So the second one is abstaining from divisive speech. Divisive speech. So this is speech that we use to create division, to create separation. Like, hey, do you know what Johnny said about you? That kind of a thing. It's some of our gossip, some of our ways we like to share information. But if you look and see, is that done from a way, is it from a place of trying to create separation, of create tension, to create maybe me against them mentality, to stir up ill feelings? Another sutta of the Buddha speaks of it this way: abandoning divisive speech, she abstains from divisive speech. What she has heard, she does not tell there to break those apart from those people here. What he has heard, he does not tell here to break those apart from those people there. Thus reconciling those who are broken apart or cementing those who are united, she loves concord, delights in concord, enjoys concord, and speaks things that create concord. So a quality of divisiveness, to notice the intentionality that comes behind that. Now, communication, as we speak about it at the end for your homework, really asks us to pause a little bit, to allow ourselves to bring our wisdom into that communication, to see what's the intention behind what I'm about to say. I think, what's the acronym? Why am I speaking? There's an acronym from, I think, Sylvia Bordstein, who's wait. Okay, why am I talking? That's it. Why am I talking? Just ask that periodically. Why am I talking? You know, am I talking in order to share honestly? Am I talking in order to create separation? You know, and then more and more, again, we feel that internal difference. When we're coming from a place of connection, there's a way that our heart rejoices, relaxes, appreciates that connection. And when we talk from a place of divisiveness, of creating separation, there's a whole different internal experience. And we become more and more sensitive the more we practice. And we start to feel like, oh, I just don't want to create that division. I don't want to create that separation. And we learn. And we learn. We speak something. We find that it was coming from a divisive place. And we pause. We acknowledge that. And we try to repair that. We do repair it the best we can. We make the lesson as much deeply learned as we can and resolve to not do that again. So abstaining from divisive speech. The next one is refraining from abusive speech. Okay, these are the words that we have the intention to cause harm, to cause hurt, to criticize, to attack, you know, externally, how we lash out before we even realize. You know, the road rage, the insults we throw at strangers, the insults we throw at dear ones, at family members, the abusive speech. Now, what if, this is a nice time to say this, what if we included all our speech externally as well as internally? Has anyone ever had a negative thought toward themselves that might come into this category of abusive speech, that self-criticism, that self-judgment? Yeah? Anyone ever say anything that may not be completely true to yourself? It's really interesting when you just catch your self narrative and just to pause and say, was that really true this thing I keep rehearsing and saying again and again to myself, is that absolutely true? Or is it just a belief that I've adopted, a strategy that I've taken up? That starts to loosen that grip of self-narrative, of self-criticism. And the Buddha spoke in this one of speaking only the speech, speak only the speech that neither torments self nor does harm to others. That speech is truly well spoken. Speak only endearing speech, speech that is welcome. Speech when it brings no evil to others is pleasant. Right? So he's saying that something that brings no evil, no harm is perceived as being pleasant. Another short line is abandoning abusive speech. She abstains from abusive speech. She speaks words that are soothing to the ear, that are affectionate, and that go to the heart, that are polite, appealing, and pleasing to people at large. Okay, so abusive speech, you can see there's abstaining from that, and there's also speaking from a kindness of heart. So this is, you know, this is ideal. Even when we have to give feedback or something that's difficult, can we say in a kind way, in a way that's coming from a place of heartness, of kindness, of politeness? Now, the sense of being pleasing, of being gentle, endearing speech, is a little bit of a contradiction with this other sutta that I mentioned. Okay, so this is around whether something being pleasant or not pleasant to hear. So I want to give a little bit more of the backstory around that sutta. So this is actually a very interesting sutta because there's this prince who was talking to some of the Buddha's rivals. Okay, so the Buddha had rivals. He had rival teachers who wanted to show him up to prove he wasn't so great after all. You know, he was trying to take his students. There's all this stuff going on back there. So this one prince was kind of caught up in it. And some of the Buddha's rivals or enemies were saying, okay, I want you to go trick up the Buddha. I want you to catch him in this. And then give you this question to ask him. Okay, the question is around, you know, the Buddha, he was asking the Buddha, would you say words that are both unendearing, that are unendearing and disagreeable to others? So this is really a trap or a trick that was set. The idea is that the Buddha said, yes, I would. I would say stuff that's unagreeable. And they'd say, well, how are you no different than the run-of-the-mill person who does this all the time? Well, on the other hand, if the Buddha says, oh, I would never say that, then this is where the trap comes in. Then how, Lord, did you say of Devadatta? So Devadatta was one of the Buddha's cousins, I believe, and kept trying to really... He tried to overthrow the Sangha. He tried to kill the Buddha a few times. So the Buddha is speaking to Devadatta and said that Devadatta is headed for destitution. The Devadatta is headed for hell. Devadatta will boil for an eon. Devadatta is incurable. Okay, so if you see, you're not going to say anything unpleasant. For Devadatta was upset and disgruntled at those words of yours. Right. So the idea is that, okay, we're going to trick the Buddha. If he says, oh no, I would never say anything that. Well, you did say something. If you say you would say something of, you know, that's unpleasant, then you're just normal, a normal kind of person. And this rival said that when the Buddha is asked this two-pronged question, he won't be able to swallow it or spit it up. Like a two-pronged question, like a two-horned chestnut. If you swallowed it, it would get stuck in your throat. You couldn't spit it out and you couldn't swallow. You know, a very vivid graphic image. So what the Buddha said is that there's neither a yes or no to that question. And that kind of threw that whole trap away. This is where the Buddha went into that. Really, it doesn't matter if it's pleasing or not pleasing. It only matters if it's both true and beneficial. It's only true and beneficial. So I think sometimes we get caught up in spiritual life that we have to say everything in a very polite way, a very nice and kind way. And sometimes that's just not what's needed for the situation. And sometimes we need to have a little more fire, a little more energy as we speak. But if we're speaking, see a couple people, a couple in here smiling at each other. So there's that fire, that feistiness that sometimes is needed. But if it's coming from a place that's both true and beneficial, then the timing, just seeing when's the right timing. And the suttas have, the Buddha wasn't always really nice and pleasant. Sometimes he would call people idiots. He would say, you're a stupid one. He would just kind of lay it out there if they were being that way, because he had all kinds of characters coming in and trying to ask him questions and misunderstood. But he would come from a place of compassion, of kindness. What's needed for this person's growth, their development? Sometimes not saying anything is what's needed. Sometimes confronting them is what's needed. Sometimes being very compassionate and kind was what's needed. So any time we have to give feedback, tell something in a way that may not be welcome, to do it in a kind heart, to feel that connection with your heart before you speak. So this is abstaining from abusive speech. So the final one is abstaining from idle chatter. Okay, so this one's a little challenging for lay people, I think, because, you know, we have a lot of idle chatter that we talk about. Now, if we had really devoted our lives in a way a monastic would, that their whole life from moment of waking to moment of sleeping is really devoted to the practice, this particular one makes more sense. So the sutta speaks of it this way, abandoning idle chatter. He abstains from idle chatter. He speaks in season, speaks what is factual, what is in accordance with the goal, the Dharma, and the rules of conduct. He speaks words worth treasuring, seasonable, reasonable, circumscribed, connected with the goal. So everything's oriented toward awakening. So again, this is a challenging, it's a very high standard for us. And I think really if we're able to do the first three, we're doing quite well. If we can really avoid abstaining from speaking what is not true, you can speak what is true. You can find the timing of beneficialness of that. We can speak in a way that's not abusive. And also that doesn't create division. That's enough. And if you find yourself chatting with a neighbor about how the weather is or how the Mariners are doing and their Seahawks or whatever you like, yes, that's idle, but focus on the connection. Focus on that sense of coming from your heart and speaking what is true. And I think that would be very wise in our speech. So wise speech. Another sutta, we can summarize the whole scope of it from a more of a positive standpoint, you know, what to speak. Okay, this wise speech is spoken at the right time. It is spoken in truth. It is spoken affectionately. It is spoken beneficially. It is spoken with a mind of goodwill. So these five elements, spoken at the right time, spoken in truth, is spoken affectionately, and is spoken beneficially. And finally, is spoken with a mind of goodwill. Right? So we see a sense of timing. What's the right timing to speak? Is it the truth? Is it a relative truth? Is it an absolute truth? Is it just my truth? And maybe I want to hear the other person's truth. Is it spoken from a place of affection, of kindness, of caring for this other person's well-being? Is it spoken beneficially? And is it spoken of a mind, with a mind of goodwill? These are the four elements of wise speech. I know there's five elements that were just listed, but the four main elements of, you know, of truthfulness, of non-division, of non-abuse, and also of not being so idle, idle chatter. So how do we start to bring this teaching into our actual lives, into actually how we interact with people. How do we actually communicate, whether we're texting or doing social media, Snapchat, Instagram, email, phone calls. So going back to that sutta when the Buddha is talking to his seven-year-old son, he said to Rahula, what do you think, Rahula? What is a mirror for? What is a mirror for? For reflection. So in the same way, Rahula, bodily actions, verbal actions, and mental actions are to be done with repeated reflection. Right? So looking at how the mirror reflects you. So that's a reflection of our actions, how we act. So actions of body, of speech, and of mind. So tonight we're focusing on mental, but we could do the same exploration of how we use our bodies and how we use our minds. Isn't that fascinating how our minds are also a form of action? We kind of think we can just, you know, think whatever we want, but really we're generating karma, generating sankharas constantly through our repetitive thoughts. And we're digging those grooves deeper in how we think. So the Buddha said, so reflect on your speech before, during, and after. Okay, this is going to come into our homework here for this week. So whenever you want to perform a verbal act, whenever you have this impulse to speak, before you say it, reflect. Okay, this verbal act I want to perform, would it lead to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both? Is it unskillful, your verbal act, with painful consequences, painful results? And as you have that impulse to speak, to pause and to connect with them. If it seems like, oh yeah, this is going to cause some harm, this is not going to be very well received, pausing and maybe choosing to find a different way of handling that. On the other hand, if it feels like, yeah, there's no harm that's going to come from that, then enjoy that, speak that, enjoy how it has that quality of harmony. This is before we speak, before we communicate. Then while we're in the act of communicating, to notice, checking with the body, say, okay, how is this feeling? How is that quality of resonance? I often come back to the body. I don't know if that resonates with most of you or not, but it's such a great template, such a great mechanism of feedback. If I'm speaking something that's unkind or untrue, my body is telling me it. My body is saying, you know, this is tightening. It's getting contracted. It's different than the quality of speaking something I might be embarrassed about or ashamed about or unsure about just how it's going to be received. That's a different quality. But when I am actually going against what's actually true, I can feel that dissonance in my body. So the Buddha also told his son, and he tells us through the sutta, to, in the midst of communication, to pay attention, to reflect. You know, is this going to cause harm? Would it lead to self-affliction? Will it cause harm to myself, affliction to others, or to both? Is it unskillful? Is it following all these elements of wise speech? Will it cause painful consequences, painful results? Or will it be of benefit? Will it actually be of help? And then finally, after speaking, after communicating, after hitting that send, I love that Google, I have like a 20-second window to unsend something. I do that more often than I think. I got to make sure it was actually wise. I wrote well in that email. So reflecting afterwards, you know, okay, was that really skillful? Was that kind? Was that coming from a warm heart? And sometimes you don't know till you get the feedback as people come back with you what they said. Of course, there's the important thing to realize that our intentionality is different than the impact of our actions. And can we have this intentionality of non-harm, but if our actions have harm, it's important to listen because we may be causing harm in ways we don't understand. Like talking about last week with racism and all this unconsciousness around it, we can often come from a place of harm without even realizing it. So be willing to hear that, to hear that feedback, to reflect on that, and to learn. That's the bottom line, is how do we learn? So wise speech, this, all the different ways we communicate and speak to each other, texting, electronic, bringing more consciousness to that action. I think it will be very enriching, not only for our own lives, for our own well-being, but for all people that we encounter. All right, let's just sit quietly for a few moments, and then we'll talk about the homework and or practice and reflection, as we call it these days. All right, thank you for your engagement. And before we open to any questions or communication or around communication, I want to talk about the homework. And Dara, could you share that with the online people? And hopefully you had a chance to pick it up here, those in the room. So this week, bring attention to communication in all forms, from verbal to written to electronic. Right. So see, and also it's interesting, notice what ones do you tend to be extra conscious around and perhaps extra unconscious around? And what do you really automatically pay attention to and which ones you don't? So consider the elements of wise speech. So is it spoken at the right time? Is it spoken in truth? Is it spoken affectionately? Is it spoken beneficially? Is it spoken with a mind of goodwill? And so reflect before, during, and after communicating these questions that the Buddha spoke of. This verbal act I am doing, is it leading to self-affliction, to the affliction of others, or to both? Is it an unskillful verbal act with painful consequences, painful results? So bringing that, you know, you can take this on for every communication you do, or just maybe periods of your time, of your day, just bring a little more awareness to these questions. Okay, is this really a wise speech? Is this skillful speech? You know, and you might feel a little like, okay, I don't know how I'm going to speak, be all uptight, and be willing to make some mistakes and to kind of stumble. We don't want to get too uptight around it. So hopefully, were you guys able to get the chat for it? Yes, great. Okay, so we have a chance now for any comments or sharing or questions, both here in the room and also in the Zoom room. So if you'd like to share anything, go ahead and you can raise your virtual hand or you can raise your physical hand. Katie, go ahead.
Thanks, Tim. let me bring my hand down. Yeah, so I was really glad that we were having this conversation, this Dhamma talk tonight, because I've been thinking a lot about this, in particular at work. And I've just really been struggling because In my job, I'm a leader, and I have kind of noticed through my Dhamma practice that I've kind of set up this relationship with my boss where I kind of like tell him everything that's going on at work and kind of where people are messing up or if something doesn't seem right to me. So I kind of have started to feel like an informant, or something like that. But I've, you know, the past few months have been like practicing taking the precepts every morning and really thinking about the fourth precept. And it's starting to make me feel just saying anything bad about anyone is really starting to make me feel like physically ill. And there's like a lot of tightness in my chest. And a couple of things. One is, I guess there's some self-judgment and like self-frustration because taking the precepts, I'm like very aware. And yet it feels like it almost has this kind of like addictive quality sometimes. And I find myself still doing it, like still saying something negative about someone or complaining to another coworker about someone at work. And it's just become very negative. And I know that. And I just like, I keep doing like, I did it again this morning and I've been really trying not to. So that's kind of frustrating. And so I'm wondering how to work with that and kind of how to hopefully over time, like break that habit more and more, because the other piece of it is that, I put my notice in at work a week ago and I mean, it's giving me opportunities to practice at my current role, but with my next boss, I just want to set up a different relationship around that. I really want to like take some kind of vow to really be more careful around my speech and really show up differently in like the next leadership role that I have. But I just have fear that it's going to be the same again, where I keep breaking that. And I get I'm only human. I'm not enlightened and I'm going to mess up, but I'd like to mess up less. And I don't know. It's just, it makes me feel really icky. And I don't like it. And yet I keep doing it. So that's just kind of my reflection. And I'm just wondering what advice you have around that and working with that more, since I am being very conscious of it, but it still doesn't seem like quite enough. So thank you.
Okay, good. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's true that the more sensitive we get internally, we can start to feel the dissonance and how internally painful it is to speak ill of someone else. And so that's great that that's growing. But at the same time, you're kind of in this momentum of that current position where that's kind of what you've set up. That's the dynamic that you've set up. And so the good news, I mean, I assume it's good news that you're changing positions. And so when you start something new, it's much easier to start in the way that you feel most integritous with, you know, and if you have in the same position, having to kind of tell a boss about other people's mistakes and failings, you can say that, you know, I feel uncomfortable about this. I like to do it in the kindest way possible. You know, I like them to know that I'm giving the feedback or whatever it is, and kind of bring that whole thing to the forefront to say that I care about the people I'm supervising as well as the person who's supervising me. I care about the mission of the company, and I want to really be as integritous as I can and as kind as I can to people. And so that's kind of, you have a new way of starting, just like in a, you know, a new relationship, a new friendship, we can start fresh. Well, it's a little harder if you've been sitting with someone for 30 years to kind of try to change the dynamics. It's very possible, but it's often a little rocky because things have been set up based on those dynamics. And as our ethics change, as our wisdom changes, you know, the people around us, the situation around us either have to change or we have to learn to adapt to that, or maybe we have to find new situations. So there's that piece. The other piece around that, the reason why you keep doing it, even though it feels yucky, that quality of addiction around it. So I often think of it as like if you touched a hot stone and it burnt your hand, you probably want to pick up that stone again. You would know, okay, that's really painful if you really felt the burn. And it's like you're feeling the ickiness of it, but you're not feeling the underlying suffering and how that suffering is really self-induced. And so try this, like the homework this week is to reflect before you speak, while you're speaking, and after. And not only, you know, whether that was, you know, because that was divisive, that was abusive, but to go more deeply around it. Notice how it benefits you, how it serves you to create that sense of division or being, you know, gossip or whatever it might be. Because there's some way that it does feed us to continue to do that. And if that part's not seen, then the thing keeps perpetuating. Right? Does that make sense? And it takes a lot of honesty to be willing to do that.
Yeah, I think I'm like scared of what that under that.
And as a spiritual practitioner, that scare, I don't know if I want to see that, we start to realize, okay, I have to go see that. It's like, I don't know, I sometimes have these images come up from movies, like, it's like you're Luke Skywalker, and you've got to go into that cave that Yoda says don't go into. Because, you know, there's something there you have to see. You know, it's just kind of that, you just realize you have to see that. That fear is actually a guidepost. It shows you that's where you're consolidated. That's where you're identified. And you're threatened, by seeing, you're threatening some of that deeper identification. If you're not identified, you're not so formed. You're not so, the sense of Katie, the sense of Tim, the sense of whoever is not so formed, not so developed. And that's threatening to a part of our ego. And part of our heart really yearns for that.
Makes sense.
All right. Thank you, Katie. All right. Let's go with Austin next. Go ahead, Austin.
Hello. I'm assuming you can hear me. My thought is about silence, and would love your perspective about what the Dharma says about silence in relationship to communication. Not silence as the absence of communication either, or in the negation of communication. I've observed in my own practice over the years, as it's deepened, my relationship to silence has evolved to the point where I notice sometimes in situations where I might crack a joke or say something witty, I can almost feel the witty comment in me well before it comes out, and I'm silent and it goes away, and I know, oh, I could have communicated, but the silence itself feels like it's communicating. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about silence as it relates to this teaching and how we can incorporate it into the homework and our ongoing practice.
Thank you, Austin. So, and you're speaking particularly on silence, not as a, like you should say something, but you're not saying, but more just how silence can be a form of communication in itself. Yeah, I think, and there's a silence that can be kind of disconnected, but are you talking more about the silence, which is really actually very connected? Because there's a way that when we really are connecting with another person, sometimes words fail us because it's like we just see that just pointing towards some element of, you know, our ideas about that person, but there's this richness of who they are and what's being said. And sometimes silence is the most appropriate thing, the most, feels like the most integritous thing. And also, like with the example of cracking a joke and seeing, okay, seeing that arise and pass away, sometimes you can say is the joke to kind of, you know, to feel connected, to create a sense of community, a sense of awkwardness with the silence, or is it just you're okay being silent with this other person? And I think it's often it can be really rich to feel so comfortable with someone that you can be quiet with them. You don't have to fill the space with words. And so I would just trust that. I trust that sense of silence when it's really coming from your depth of your practice, in the way the heart's awakening, and just let that silence be communicated through your eyes, through your presence, and also see sometimes that people do need some words to be put in there too. Yeah. All right. Does that help, Austin? Is there anything else around that? All right. Thank you for asking that. That's an important thing, and we will explore that more as we go through this month. So I'm going to see if there's anyone here in the room who likes to share anything. Yes, Deb.
Thank you for this topic. Sometimes I want to speak in relationship to someone else's speech. For example, watching the news. My husband gets irate about something. Could be about a current political situation. He's clearly irate and he's impatient. Right now, he gets irate and impatient about particular things. It's kind of a pattern a little bit now. And he'll go off ranting and raving, why don't these people, blah, 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 what is so idiots, blah, 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 you know. And I think, well, I could say something, but I don't know if that's wise. First of all, I think it would be kind of futile for me to say something. But is it wise to say anything? And then I begin to examine my own reactions to what he's saying. You know, and then there's that whole thing about, well, what is true? So it gets very complicated very quickly, but I am aware of a growing sense of my own impatience of, you know, can't you just calm down for crying out loud? You know, why are you exploding all the time about this? I don't really know where to go with this, but I'm just aware of, like, I'm on the verge of saying something, but I think it would be a mistake in that moment.
Okay.
Although I think it would be true. but probably not the official and certainly not the right time. Yeah.
Okay.
That's probably not the right time. So it just mixes everything.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess that's the teaching, right? If it's not the right time.
Well, there's a few elements here. So you guys couldn't hear anything online, right? A little bit? So you could hear just a little bit? Okay. All right, so that's good to know. So I'm going to paraphrase that, see if I capture what you're saying, Deb. So talking about sometimes wanting to speak in response to someone else's verbiage, in particular, a dear one who's a husband who's getting irate about something going on the TV and feeling like, oh, you want to say something to that, to in some ways confront that or meet that. But also kind of being in some ways a little paralyzed about I want to speak what's true. And now I have to know if it's beneficial and now I have to know if it's the right timing. And there's like this, you're not sure how to say it and when to say it. And at the same time, there's also resentment that the person keeps spouting out. Does that basically cover it? Okay. That covers the waterfront there. Okay, so this is kind of the interesting thing that we get into as spiritual practitioners, and we have our own expression of that as Dharma practitioners, that we want to speak well, we want to speak kindly, but then we get kind of paralyzed by that intention itself. And so learning how to find, reclaim that spontaneity. And it's often, I think, most of us have to go through this kind of awkward phase of, I don't want to keep doing what I've always done, which was just yell at him and tell him he's full of it, because my heart's not aligned with that anymore. But I don't know what to say instead, and I still feel that urge to yell or to be upset, right? And so this is kind of going in maybe into the, hopefully what I'll talk about in 2 weeks is that kind of back and forth and that relational thing. And so I think often with communication, we have to look at there's what's being said. There's actual, this is true or not true, beneficial or not. But there's also, we have to be able to meet each other. We actually have to have that point of contact. So you could be speaking something that's very true and very factual and very beneficial. But if there's no one to meet that, it's just kind of going off in the wind. And so this is the part that, you know, for myself, it's learning how my natural tendency, my natural personality, my natural conditioning, how I was raised by my parents and the culture I grew up in, there's a way that I'm supposed to act or speak. Okay? And sometimes that's not what's needed in that moment. And so what the Dharma teaches you is that freedom from that constraint. Like, this is who Tim always is, so Tim can't say it this way. There's that spontaneity that maybe rising to say, you know, start to complain with them, start to yell at the TV along with them. So suddenly you're resonating with them. And then once you say, oh, wow, you're resonating with me. And they say, wow, that's, and then maybe you just gently redirect it to, well, those people must be having a hard time. Can you imagine if that was what they thought? And so that way, instead of being in this opposition, you're suddenly resonating with that person. And to do that, you have to be willing to set aside your own views, your own opinions, at least temporarily, sometimes your own values, to be able to connect. But then once that connection is there, then you can start to dance and see, okay, what's really happening here? What's really going on? And sometimes, I mean, that's sometimes in the midst of that. That's one example. Sometimes later on when he's not watching, he's not triggered, say, can I talk about something? And ask for that permission and say, you know, I noticed that when you really start to yell at the TV, this is what I feel. This is what my experience is. And really own your own experience. And so you've asked permission and you're in that sense of connection and you're speaking your truth. So that's kind of what comes to mind around that. You see how it's not like we have to be careful of getting the Dharma in the way of all our skillful interpersonal skills and techniques that we can bring forth. So that's what comes to mind around that. Does that help, Deb? All right, the second option is, yeah, that's, I was thinking, yeah, that probably the first option is more, I don't know if it's more so, but just kind of play with that, see if that sometimes makes sense. It does ask you to step outside your normal comfort zone. But that, you know, that second option of just saying, okay, this is really what's going on, and maybe spend that time, you know, writing out, okay, this is what I'm feeling. This is what my experience is. This is what it triggers. Maybe it triggers your childhood in some way. And then that grittiness can actually turn to a place of intimacy, of connection. The next time he feels reacted, if he really listened to you and you really spoke and you heard his perspective, you might, oh, maybe I'll say, okay, Deb, I'm going to yell at the TV for a little bit. You might want to step out. And do you find that sense of harmony? That's why communication, it's not just speaking what's true. It's not just what's beneficial. It's not just the right timing. It's also that dance, learning to dance with each other, to dance with someone who might have a very different experience and view of this world and this relationship. And how do you learn to respect each other and to be respected? That's why I wanted this month not to be wise speech, but communication. All right. Anyone else like to share anything here? Yeah, Carlito. Do you want to try the thing again? And maybe hold it close to your mouth and. So Carlito, yes.
And I'm just wondering, and you were mentioning getting more of a sense of connection, you know, or intimacy.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering where's the overlap, you know, sort of between Dharma-oriented communication and maybe something more like
So do you guys hear that or not really? No? So the question is around where's the overlap between kind of wise speech and versus something like nonviolent communication. You're trying to understand kind of a person's deeper needs and meet that and address that. Well, you know, Rosenberg was a Buddhist practitioner, and so that is kind of steeped in that whole, you know, philosophy in itself. And of course, many Buddhist practitioners use that. How can I speak here in a way that's I think the overlap really comes from, again, coming from that wise intention, that wise caring, you know, around it, that mind that's really imbued in, spoken with a mind of goodwill. So you connect with that, then you're naturally trying to say, okay, where is the suffering? Where is the pain? Where is the hurt here? Right. And I think the important thing is, at least for myself, is sometimes those methods, you have to be careful that you're not trying to disempower that person by saying, okay, feeding them, okay, you're feeling sad, you're feeling happy, you're feeling this or that. But to really focus more on that listening, that sense of kind of undefended meeting that other person. Because sometimes those techniques, if they're done in a way that's more contrived or a little bit more, you know, like a scripted, there's a way that becomes this separation. Like, you know, so are you feeling, you know, I go through my list of the 10 different emotions and trying to find the ones that really match. So sometimes it can have that quality of distancing. Sometimes it can really have a quality of deep resonancing. A resonance with that person. Yeah, that's the right phrase. That's the right word. You've given voice to what I'm not able to say. So it all comes down to that quality of feedback, of dialogue, of saying something and then seeing what comes back. This is that back and forth. So that's what I hope to focus on in 2 weeks, is that back and forth of something shared. How does it land? How is it received? What comes back? How do I receive it? How do I, and that kind of that dance back and forth.
Right, because it feels almost like you put yourself in the role of a therapist or something at that point. How is the person as opposed to have true to me?
That's right, yeah. So the question is around, the counter comment was around, you can put yourself in this place of being a therapist instead of being this pure level, this you and this other person. And that's what I was trying to get to about coming from that kind heart, that the heart isn't the one of being the one up, the one who's wiser, the one who knows more. It's being that just another human being who's cares about this another person. Yeah, so luckily the Dharma, if you pay attention, it will show us where we're held, where we're stuck. And if it doesn't, then life will give you that feedback. All right. Thank you, Carlito. All right. So any last questions online? All right. So thank you all. And next week we'll have a discussion on wise speech in particular, but communication in general. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Goodbye to everyone else that's here.